a wild time.
Books in the library. Books.
The library.
Punk ass bookshop.
The library.
Were you just putting that book away?
Come down the library.
The library.
Books in the library. Books.
I guess you didn't know we had a system.
You are listening to WREK Atlanta and a haunted audio vault. Some of you might have noticed that there was piano music, creepy, jazzy, wrecky piano music in the back of our intro. I don't know why it happened, and I don't think the board op does either. Do you?
No.
No. You have a guess? Hauntings?
Probably. It was that incantation from last week or the week before.
Yeah. Moon's haunted, bro.
Yeah, that's right.
This is Lost in the Stacks, the Research Library Rock and Roll Radio Show. I'm Charlie in the studio with Sam, Matthew, Cody, Fred, Wendy, and a guest to be named later. Each week on Lost in the Stacks, we pick a theme and then use it to create a mix of music and library talk and hauntings. Whichever you're here for, we hope you dig it.
Our show today is called Presidential Libraries. Lots of people are talking about the presidency. Everybody's talking about it. It's the greatest topic ever.
I'm not talking about it, but I hear other people talk about it.
Also talking about how the legacy of a president is created.
And the Barack Obama Presidential Library is in the news, too, because it will be the first fully digital presidential library.
And depending on your outlook, that's either interesting or disheartening.
So we're going to talk about, broadly, what do we mean by presidential libraries today? What's the point? What does that digital library signify? And what do we think would best represent a presidential legacy?
If you want to join the conversation, the hashtag for this show is LITS427 for Lost in the Stacks, episode 427. Feel free to tweet your thoughts, questions, or pictures of yourself in the Hall of Presidents with that hashtag.
Our songs today are about the influence of status, propaganda, and control, like always. Almost sounds like a job description for the President of the United States. So let's kick it off with President Rock, which some of you might know as To the Bump, by Prince Francis, right here on Lost in the Stacks.
Yeah, To the Bump, President Rock by Prince Francis. Today's show is called Presidential Libraries, and joining us today is past and future guest Greg Walker of Hauser Walker Architecture, an Atlanta-based design studio that declares itself focused on cultural buildings and the culture of building. Greg, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So you have brought us this topic. This is something that interests you.
It does. These are kind of an interesting subgenre if you aren't designer of libraries, and I've done several different kinds. So, because I think they cross a lot of different genre boundaries, and I think as we're going to talk about today, they continue to kind of define really interesting typological problems for what a library is.
So there's your overview, everybody, of why we're doing this. This is actually an opinion discussion by a bunch of educated but uninformed information professionals. That was for you, Wendy. Okay.
Thank you.
Let's do a quick timeline of presidential libraries before we dig into the qualities that make, for instance, the Obama Library important to talk about, and then the larger theoretical discussion. So I have notes. I had to do some research. The first full collection of presidential papers at the Library of Congress was Andrew Jackson's. That was acquired in 1903. Turns out presidential libraries were not a thing until the mid-40s, and then they weren't a codified thing until the 50s.
And on top of that, I mean, it seems a little bit incredulous, maybe, but most presidents up until whenever the Presidential Records Act was in the late 70s, you could just walk off with your papers.
Yeah, they were
yours. You had no real obligation to treat them as a national ownership. You know, the nation didn't own them. They were yours.
Now, many of those presidents did then donate those papers back, like to the Library of Congress or to universities. They made collections out of them. Mm-hmm.
But a lot of things just disappeared. A lot of things are sitting in family homes. And it's a little interesting to, I think, what the act did in 1878 was to try and say there's a difference between the president as a person who has some ownership over the things that he does and the office of the presidency. And I think there was a recognition we need to preserve the documents that are related to the office of the presidency. And there's a fine line in what a lot of that is, but probably for all those involved who keep these kind of records, it's a little more clearly laid out.
But that was 1978.
It was.
The Records Act.
It seems crazy.
Yeah. Before that, another private thing. In 1916, the Rutherford B. Hayes Library opened. It was a collection of books that were his, which for me has always been what I thought presidential libraries really were. It's like all the books the president owned during the term and terms. And then you start the library. Okay, anyway, I'm not going to talk about how...
If that were the case, during the last year of your presidency, you'd really like want to stock up on...
You'd do a lot of reading.
Make you look a lot better, things that look good on the shelf.
That is not administered by the National Archives, the Hayes Collection.
Correct.
It's still, they have fought that. So then in the 40s, Franklin D. Roosevelt started thinking, people are going to want to know. He is known as a history buff, and so this is how he framed his understanding. Like, hey, there needs to be a library where you can do research on what happened in my term, a museum to talk about me. And of course, many people thought that that was a terrible idea, an egomaniac's idea.
Look, I think all of us probably sitting here are going to agree. Wanting to be president, period, is a kind of egomaniacal exercise. So the fact that you'd want to build a monument to that doesn't really seem, you know, that far out of line.
Yeah. So that was the first real presidential library that was then sort of handed back to the federal government. In 1955, the Presidential Libraries Act happened, and that really codified the rules for what the, and this is a real thing, what the Administrator of General Services, the head of the General Services Office, which is the separate but connected procurement office for the federal government. If the federal government is buying buildings or equipment, it goes through General Services. Everyone's just staring at me now. Okay.
It's interesting that this happened in 1978.
No, no, that's the Records
that's,
Act.
That's the Records.
Yeah.
Okay, the Records Act happened in 78.
Yeah, yeah. The General Services was 1955. That was the Presidential Libraries Act. And they said, you can buy stuff and you can talk to universities, and if you need to buy things, we'll get you some money. Like, it just laid out, like, presidential libraries are going to be a thing.
Well, the date stuck with me because it's so close to, I guess people were reflecting on the legacy of Nixon. And, like, what does it
mean?
The
records.
Yes,
right.
But for the records, if someone can just, like, walk away with those, maybe that was sort of the impetus, the driving factor.
Well, you know, the kind of broader question, which I think probably prompted, Nixon absolutely prompted the Records Act, but I think it's also kind of an interesting development that a lot of these libraries started, as you sort of said, with Roosevelt wanting to not just preserve the actual physical documents. That was definitely a part of it. But he wanted to tell a narrative about the era that his presidency occurred in. I don't know that he ever called his a museum, at least from what I've been able to see. He called it a library.
Yeah, but it's definitely called a museum.
Oh, it's called
now.
A museum now, and they almost all are. Kennedy was actually the first one, as far as I think we know, who actively called his a library and museum. But what that starts to speak to for me, and I think will become interesting as we get through the next couple of segments, is that idea of storytelling is never innocent. And it's never value-free, and it's never entirely something that you can remove from the subject.
You're speaking our language.
Yeah.
All right, now, I have to shut the segment down real quick with a fact, and then I'm going to ask all of the non-information professionals in the room a question real quick. So be ready. There are 14 presidential libraries right now. Hoover through Obama. Okay. Now, what do you all think a presidential library should do? Cody, what does that mean to you? And you can be quick about it. You don't have to explain a big thing. But what do you think a presidential library is?
I think it's, yeah, a record where I can research anything that happened in there in that term and also find out what that person thinks of themselves.
Oh, nice. Matthew?
Yeah, like a history of the administration and the individual, but also some of the events going around the administration. So not just their stuff, but associated papers, I guess.
Yeah. Sam?
And papers.
Got to get right up on that mic.
Oh, yeah. Papers that have, like, the nitty-gritty of it, of all of them, you know. Daily briefings, what was on their desk, how many jelly beans in the jar, that kind of stuff.
That's a deep cut right there.
Well, just
there.
A little stuff. Yeah, deep cut.
This is Lost in the Stacks, and we'll be back with more after a music set.
File this set under CD3029.82.V45. You just heard Into the Valley by the Skids. Before that was Older Guys by the Flying Burrito Brothers. Those were songs about influence bestowed by status and collection as propaganda.
This is Lost in the Stacks, and our show today is called Presidential Libraries. Our guest is friend of the show, Greg Walker of Hauser Walker Architecture here in Atlanta, Georgia. Greg, I'm going to quote you.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, here we go. This is something you wrote to me about this show as we were planning it. What really intrigues me, that being you, Greg, about these is the increasingly blurry line between library as an institutional resource that, at least on the surface, is supposed to be more neutral, and the library as a means of propaganda. Okay, so we're in it now. Here we go. Let's talk about neutral for about half of a segment, and then we'll talk about propaganda for half a segment. So you have, at least on the surface, as your modifier to the idea of libraries being neutral. You want to talk about that as an architect of a few libraries yourself?
Well, so I think what most of us who are not library professionals want to believe is that at some level, the kind of curatorial stance by a library tends not to preclude certain kinds of information from being available. In other words, when we all get up in arms in the lay world about libraries and the idea of kind of neutrality is when we most typically see a book being banned or a list of books being banned, and we start to question, why is the library making the judgment to say these books are not suitable for this institution? Yeah.
And you know what's hilarious? It's always because a citizen challenged it.
Of course. Absolutely. But so I think what it does speak to is that we still have a belief somewhere deep down that the library should be a kind of a more neutral pass-through filter to which we get information.
Yeah. I think it's impossible to shake, even after someone knows it in their head, they still know it and they think it in their heart, that the Library of Congress has a copy of every book.
I think they do.
Like, people feel that.
Yeah.
And then the library, sort of the platonic ideal of the library, has all the books that matter.
Mm-hmm.
And we feel maybe that librarians should not be making choices like, oh, this book, which I disagree with, should not be in the collection, or this book that I agree with should be in the collection.
Or that R. Kelly is accused of X and should we stock his CDs?
That's an ugly one.
That is an ugly one.
But it's a good example, too. Like, which decisions are made when you buy, when you weed, when you promote, or you contextualize? I think, and I'm going to drag Wendy into this now, I think that that question is a lot more important in archives than it is in libraries. Would you care to comment, you troublemaker?
Oh, boy. Well, yeah, I mean, archives are certainly not neutral, and there may be more sort of messes in them, you know, like we were talking about being able to see the nitty gritty and like how many jelly beans were in the jar. And that is like, sometimes it seems like you might get more at that in the archives, but totally these questions of what we collect, collection development, funding for the archives. I mean, the Archivist of the United States is appointed by the president. So there's like all kinds of bias embedded in
the AOTUS has to deal with the POTUS.
Indeed.
So archives, which also are sort of declaring the narrative of a time or of a place, that seems more connected to this discussion of presidential libraries.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to think about what's the division between the archives and the library, or what is the library in a presidential library? Is it the archives, or is it the museum, or like, is it the whole bundle of things together? From a design standpoint.
So I would tend to think that when these were first started, that the idea that the library really was the archive. I mean, it was the papers. And because Roosevelt specifically thought scholars would be able to come in and just, or not even scholars, but just people would be able to come in and access the actual documents, or you know, not all of them, but
yeah, he wanted to support historian work.
Right.
Yeah.
He wanted to be able to come in and have people who had an interest be able to dig through the record material that was kept and be able to shape their own thoughts about the context in which his presidency occurred and some of the decisions that he made. So in that sense, I don't think he probably saw a practical distinction between the two things. I mean, the archives were it, and maybe the library, if we want to think of it that way, is the archive the actual document, and the library the means of processing the documents and administering them.
So in presidential libraries, is the ideal then the library, the archive part of it, that has all of the documents, that is ideally more neutral, even though there are systems in place that are kind of not neutral that get those documents in there. But the museum part of it is a lot less neutral in its presentation to the public. Like, you have all the documents, mm-hmm. and someone could come in there and research something,
yep.
and come to a negative perception of that administration. That museum is always going to show a positive presentation of that administration.
I think most of us accept that distinction exists. That the museum, and the museum has never, as a kind of institution, has never been, you know, completely neutral or value free. I mean, there's always context that it's setting up through the curation of the collection and the display of the collection, and heck, even the sequencing of collections. So I don't think that most of us think that is pretending to do something other than tell a more positive narrative about a president, you know, and I've never been to Nixon's, so I don't know the sequencing of it, but it, you know, at some point in there you have to believe,
yeah.
You have to believe there is some critical telling of some sort. If the National Archives is doing their job as a storyteller, that describes what happened in the downfall.
But it's the description, really.
Oh, absolutely.
Because you said neutral and value free.
Right.
Right. And value free and neutral are
different.
Very different. Yeah. The values of a president, the values of a government, the values of a country, right, might inform how things are chosen or presented. And then neutral seems to be the all of it. The, mm-hmm. you know, the phrase everything or all of it that happened. But even that's kind of, I don't want to say a lie agreed upon, that all of it. No collection is ever all of it, right?
It can't be, but let's, you know, for a second, let's maybe try to see if we can talk about this though in terms that do put a kind of more value-free part on it. I think from an archival standpoint, we hope that's value-free in the sense that, especially with the Presidential Records Act, this stuff's being collected no matter what it is, good, bad, or ugly. And it's just going and being stored.
Right.
Okay. So if we accept that at face value, that the presidents aren't going through, as we talked a little bit off air, and curating their own materials and saying, well, I don't want you to have that 15 minutes of tape or whatever the 13 minutes of tape.
18.
18 minutes of tape. You know, I don't want you to have that. I want you to have everything else. Then we can start to say that at least the archival part of this is more a little bit more value free. And so the historian that comes in after, or the you know, whoever, whatever kind of scholarly work happens, you would hope that they, can have some ability to pursue that kind of research without having to have the narrative of who the president was overlaid on top.
And we're going to be back with more from Greg Walker about presidential libraries on the left side of the hour.
Hello, I'm the life form known as Robin Hitchcock, and you are you, and you are listening to Lost in the Stacks on WREK Atlanta. Have a nice day.
And on the eighth day, when he had rested, he created darkness.
Today's Lost in the Stacks is called Presidential Libraries, and I have two excerpts to read to you. The first is from the website for the Franklin D. Roosevelt Presidential Library and Museum, under the heading, What is a Presidential Library? Presidential libraries are not libraries in the usual sense. They are archives and museums, bringing together in one place the documents and artifacts of a president and his administration, and presenting them to the public for study and discussion without regard for political considerations or affiliations. Presidential libraries and museums, like their holdings, belong to the American people. It's pretty nice.
Perfectly value-free.
Then, from a New York Times article published this February, titled The Obama Presidential Library That Isn't, by Jennifer Schulzer. Gosh, I can't pronounce it. I'm sorry, Jennifer. There's concern that the creation of a privately run presidential museum undermines the ideal of nonpartisan public history. Timothy Naftali, the former director of the Richard Nixon Library, where he is credited with overhauling museum exhibits to give a more honest accounting of Watergate, called the decision a huge mistake. It was astounding to me that a good presidency would do this, Mr. Naftali said. It opens the door, he added, to a truly terrible Trump library. Well, while you think about that, we are going to file this set under E176.1.U69.
You just heard Reclamation by Fugazi, and before that was Singing the Praises by Delta 5. Those are songs about remembrance and taking control of one's legacy.
Our show today is called Presidential Libraries. Our guest, Greg Walker, an Atlanta architect, has joined us for a conversation sparked by the Obama Presidential Library. But let's look forward past the presidents we know about. Greg, in your view, what do we want presidential libraries to do ideally?
So I think as every institution like this has evolved over the last 60 years, I mean, libraries don't do today what they did 60 years ago. I think we have to ask, what is the most civically minded, forward thinking kind of a contribution that they can make? And so I will look back a little bit to that and say that one of the impressive things about the Carter Library that we have here in town is the fact that they really, I think out of all of these institutions, stepped up the idea that it wasn't just a museum and it wasn't just the archive, but that it was going to be an ongoing center for a kind of dialogue about public life. And that doesn't have as much to do with the architecture. I mean, that just means you put a nice, big, generous auditorium in there and maybe some other kind of supporting facilities. But it's really a kind of a mindset shift. It was to say, This isn't just a place you come and consume history. It is a part about how we are going to discuss what is the future history. So I think to answer your question, I'd love to see or think that some of those kinds of libraries will continue to promote a kind of discourse around how we see the role of government and how we see the role of politics in the culture.
And that's the value that the library is not free of, right?
Right.
Or the center or the museum or whatever you want to call it. And so if we think about the Carter Center being in some way an attractive sort of acceptance of the lack of neutrality or the sort of recognition that the library is not really
the benevolent dictator.
Oh, is he a dictator? Is
no,
Carter?
He's
come
not.
On.
He's not.
We gotta. I mean, you know, maybe like when he's actually building a house, he might take charge.
When he's the superintendent, yes.
So if we extend that out, like, so there is a sense of not just consuming history, and I'll add to your thought and say actually creating history, right. Contextualizing pieces of information that are available in the collection. Mm-hmm. What else do we know exists in various libraries, presidential libraries, that we want to see continue, and how will those form, you know, an ideal presidential library in the future?
So I think the one thing that has been a constant up until now is that they housed the physical documents. And so part of what started this discussion, as you kind of mentioned earlier, is that the Obama Library is going to be the first to not house the physical records on site. And they're going to digitize the entire collection and make the entire collection done that way. Now, obviously, within the museum component, they're going to have some physical artifact. You know, they'll have numerous physical artifacts that are tied to whatever the narrative of the particular exhibits are. But it is a little bit of an interesting question, because I think as those of us who have done scholarly research and still do some scholarly research, it's totally different to say, I'm looking at the source material versus I'm looking at a reproduction of it. I mean, now you're already one step removed from what is the authentic.
But if I have to try and make a case for it, I would say that a digital collection can be found in many different places besides just a on-site.
Yes.
You know, in the museum.
You would think.
Next to where it would say, like, this is what were you going to say?
I mean, the flip side of that would be, if it's completely digitized, are you putting that out and making it accessible to everyone?
Yeah.
In a way that you can't do with the physical records.
One hopes there's not a site license on the records.
You'd hope.
Of the Obama Library.
Well, you know, they are going to privatize part of the operations, I think, as we were talking about. And
privatize the stuff that's private already, really, right?
To some degree.
Yeah.
Except that the archives still actually maintains the museums, as you kind of talked about in your first quote, in the last segment or towards the end of the last segment, with the former director of the Nixon Library. I mean, that's somebody who works for the National Archives. Mm-hmm. They are coming in and reorganizing the curatorial content of the exhibits, to perhaps tell a little more robust story. Now, that may or may not have been able to happen in President Nixon's own lifetime, right? And this is where we get into a really interesting discussion about how do the presidents themselves get to control the narrative that's being told, and how much of that can we bank on being the actual truth or some version of truthiness or outright fabrication.
Yeah, so the Obama Presidential Library appears to be taking a lot more control right at the start.
Over the museum.
And kind of leaning into the things that are, quote-unquote, problems with presidential libraries. Mm-hmm. And do we imagine that whenever the Obama family is detached enough from the foundation and the library in the future, and I'm not going to just say when someone's dead, but like when the Obama presidency is much more conceptual rather than immediate for the Obama family, do you think that it'll be renovated and revised as other libraries have been?
I think they've all undergone some revision, and definitely in the museums. I mean, the Eisenhower is under renovation right now. I think one of the other ones, the museum galleries, are under renovation. And that seems to me to be a healthy process, right? I mean, going back and looking at what is the story that we're telling? Did we get the story right the first time? Are there new facts and revelations or context that helps us see what the actions of this person really were? So that's a healthy process to me.
So we're almost done with the segment. So I want to ask you an architect's question.
It's flying.
I know, that goes fast. So I just want to ask you a simple question that I'm sure you can answer in like a sentence.
You don't know me well, do you?
How important is it that a story is locked into a location, a building, versus maybe disseminated virtually in pieces, you know, connected to everyone's sort of device?
I think the story sans physical objects certainly can be disseminated in a wide variety of ways. But these aren't stories to some degree without some corresponding artifact. And I think the actual artifact still matters.
Well, this is Lost in the Stacks, and our guest today has been Greg Walker of the Hauser Walker Architecture. It's an Atlanta-based design studio focused on cultural buildings and the culture of building. Greg, thank you so much for being
on
the show.
Thank you.
File the set under PS2151.J6V3. Kind of spooked now. That was The Willing Machine by Lady President. Before that was Don't Change by The Turbo Fruits. Those were songs about hoping for one outcome but realizing the forces are pushing it towards a different goal.
You got real emotional about that, Matthew.
I really felt it, you know?
Yeah.
Really felt it.
Our show today is called Presidential Libraries.
Presidential libraries have been a thing, like a real official federally funded thing, for only 64 years.
And 64 years, it turns out, is not long enough to figure out exactly what we want to do with them.
Roll the credits.
Lost in the Stacks is a collaboration between WREK Atlanta and the Georgia Tech Library. Produced by Charlie Bennett, Amit Doshi, Wendy Hagemeyer, and Fred Rasko.
Matthew was our engineer today, and the show was brought to you in part by the Library Collective, which has announced the theme of next year's conference. You can learn more at thelibrarycollective.org.
Legal counsel and what appears to be a plan for a Theodore Roosevelt Library in North Dakota were provided by the Burris Intellectual Property Law Group in Atlanta, Georgia.
Special thanks to Greg for being on the show today, to every NARA employee who has to handle a presidential collection, and thanks, as always, to each and every one of you for listening. You can find us online at lostinthestacks.org, and you can subscribe to our podcast pretty much anywhere you get your audio fix.
Next week on Lost in the Stacks, our show is called The Library Between the Lines, and we are all eager to find out what that means.
All right, time for our last song today. Presidential libraries, for all their desire to be a place of scholarship and research, are ultimately celebrations of presidential men. One wonders what the first female president will do with her collected papers and documents. Regardless, so far, it seems that anyone who occupies the office of the presidency feels that they deserve a place in the Valhalla of prominent American historical figures. I love what you've done here, Fred. Let's close with a big side eye to that concept of prominent American historical figures. This is American Valhalla by Iggy Pop, right here on Lost in the Stacks. Have a great weekend, you Vikings.